but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
I have a rule that I like to follow. It is a 48-hour rule. Have you heard of the 48-hour rule? It means you need to give 48 hours when you see these news stories that break, these major national news stories. You need to give it 48 hours before you can fully claim to have maybe the full picture. And we've seen a number of these things with big-time breaking news stories and whatever. Well, Sharone Moore's story, I think the first 24 hours of it has been fascinating. Fired by Michigan, detained by police, wild sequence of events for Michigan football. And it looks like the people who were in the know at Michigan are not surprised by what is happening. Like that this was sort of a secret within the palace, so to speak, until it wasn't. But Michigan has fired its football coach, did that yesterday. This is just the last 24 hours. And Michigan said they launched an investigation that found evidence that Moore had an inappropriate relationship with a staffer in his recruiting department. Certainly, I'll get into like the what's wrong with that. But ESPN initially reported the firing. University announced it very soon after, within minutes. Later in yesterday's show, it was reported that police had detained Moore. He was transferred through a couple of jails. He ended up in a county jail there. And we had this big discussion about him. Like, you know, 17-8 over two seasons. He, coached Michigan in the wake of Jim Harbaugh through the Connor Stallions scandal. You know, 9-3 this year, lose to Ohio State. He had a two-game suspension because of the Connor Stallions thing. Michigan headed to the Cheez-It Bowl to play Texas. And according to police records, the police responded to a call for an alleged assault investigation. And Moore was not named originally in this police report. Police did not initially share more information, but later indicated that, hey, this was the Michigan football coach who was in custody. Certainly, Michigan football trying to, you know, right the ship. They take Biff Pogge, who stepped in and replaced Sharone Moore in the games that he was suspended earlier in the season. They played Central Michigan and Nebraska. Pogge stepped in and served the team well in that capacity. But in the half an hour after the news of the firing broke, we were on air. Ward Manuel, the Michigan AD, comes out with a statement. I remember it was an hour and one yesterday, you know, saying that his football coach has been terminated. Credible evidence was found that he engaged in an inappropriate relationship. Conduct constitutes a clear violation of university policy, and Michigan maintains a zero tolerance for such behavior, and they move on. They are firing him with cause, which means, you know, Michigan is hoping, I think, that they don't owe him anything. Meanwhile, everybody's sort of sorting through this, trying to figure out, you know, okay, by yesterday, maybe an hour three of this show, he's in jail. Police initially came out and said it did not appear that like this break-in in an apartment complex was random. Like, you know, this was somebody that they knew. And then all the details start to pour out that this is a relationship that Moore had threatened the woman allegedly that he was in the relationship with, that there was a pregnancy that was terminated, that, I mean, it just got messier and messier and messier. And I said this on yesterday's show, and I didn't mean it to be, I wasn't trying to be flippant. I wasn't trying to be dismissive of the gravity of what is going on, but I just kept thinking about the protection that the schools often give successful coaches. The way that successful coaches are protected by universities is ridiculous. And I understand why. There's a lot of money wrapped up in football and men's basketball in particular. And those are the two programs where you most often see the head coach protected when they've done some things that they shouldn't have been doing. And I've been around programs like that where it's almost like, you know, I had a newspaper editor one time say, You know, if you're got like Jerry Tarkanian when he was at Fresno State, Tark was and Bobby Knight in Indiana too. This goes for him as well. You know, those guys, there were a lot of people that wanted those guys out of those jobs. But in order to remove them from those jobs, you couldn't have like a minor scandal. It had to be a shot to the heart. It had to be a kill shot. And Bobby Knight choking that student as he walked across campus all those years ago, that's the shot that gets Bobby Knight eventually removed at Indiana. There were a lot of people that wanted him out, but he's sort of untouchable until he's not. With Sherrone Moore, I do wonder if he beats Ohio State, if they're in the college football playoff, if this isn't a 9-3 season with a Cheez-It Bowl, how much more cover he would have got. And more of this is starting to come out. It appears as though Michigan was onto this a while ago, and I think that matters. And that's why I think we have to wait another 24 hours. I think you need the 48-hour rule before we can fully grasp what is going on here. And I predicted yesterday that some of the public sentiment would shift after the initial, oh my gosh, this guy's terrible. Some of the public sentiment is bound to shift towards Michigan and what Michigan knew and when did Michigan know it? Because that stuff matters. It matters if Ward Manuel's athletic department, which now is distancing itself from Sherrone Moore. Why? Not because he had an inappropriate relationship. No, that's what they're going to say in the statement. But because there was a subsequent arrest and police were onto it and Michigan all of a sudden had to do something about it. I think that all comes out in the next 24 hours or so. It is a reminder. I heard Max Brown, the former USC quarterback who does a little podcast. I heard him talking about this yesterday about how you know, the football coach in a program it's a different job. I mean, maybe in history, the president of the United States is maybe the only job that maybe draws a comparison to this. But the head football coach at a major university, there are a lot of people vested in wanting that person, that head coach, to be successful. The coordinators, the offensive and defensive coordinators, protect the head coach. They'll fall on the sword. Position coaches protect the head coach. The athletic director protects the head coach. Why? Because if the head coach doesn't have success, all of those positions end up on the unemployment line, right? The AD's in trouble. The assistant coaches are in trouble, whatever. So there's a lot of covering for that head coach that goes on at a lot of major universities. And people are all like, hey, guy behind the scenes, you often hear about it after a coach leaves. Oh my, he was terrible to work with. Oh, he was awful to people. Oh, he did this wrong or did that wrong, or you might want to look into this or that. But there's a lot of covering up that happens for head football coaches because so many people want them to be successful. And it's true because in a, Fortune 500 company, the CEO of a company, we often compare football coaches to CEOs. The CEO of a company is not exactly like a head football coach. The CEO of a company has duties that mirror head football coaches, and that you need to delegate and that you need to have strong leadership skills and you need to set the vision and the tone and you establish culture for your company. And those things are all right. But often, your chief financial officer, your chief operating officer are looking over at the CEO going, as soon as the CEO missteps, I'm taking that job. Like, they're not there to provide full cover for that person. But in a athletic department, the football coach gets a wide berth. And I think we're going to find out more in the next 24 hours how wide that berth was for Sherrone Moore. And this extends not just to the coaches I mentioned, people that I covered, like Jerry Tarkanian and Bobby Knight, but it makes me think about Art Briles at Baylor. It makes me think about Lane Kiffin at Ole Miss. You're seeing a lot of stuff on social media about Lane Kiffin at Ole Miss, and it's almost like Ole Miss, protected him and didn't kind of out him, what his personality or what he was like. You see it at LSU when Brian Kelly left, that, Brian Kelly, we all kind of knew Brian Kelly was a jerk, but you didn't really see it and hear it from people at LSU until Brian Kelly, they knew Brian Kelly was toast. And then it was suddenly, oh my gosh, the guy's impossible to work with. Look how he treated people behind the scenes. And it surprised exactly nobody. I do think it's a reminder to, first of all, to the rest of us that, we have learned this over and over in sport when, looking at personalities like Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan, or even if you go back in history and you look at players like Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle, I mean, Mickey Mantle was a drunk and was a womanizer. And you look at the personalities of these athletes, and Kobe, obviously a complicated legacy. Tiger Woods, complicated legacy, amazing athlete. But man, you look at his personal life and how it unraveled, and you have to kind of ask yourself, like, you know, do we really know these people? We don't. We don't know these people. We don't know these coaches. We don't know these athletes. We don't know them as, and so as far as knowing what they want us to know about them, right? It's kind of like the rest of us. Like, there's a lot of posturing and public facing posturing that goes on with people in general. Athletes are no different. Coaches are no different. And it, I think it's a reminder, first and foremost, about that. Even as we look at you know, the coaches at Oregon and Oregon State and the athletes at Oregon and Oregon State and the Trailblazers players and whatnot, you know, we don't really know him. Chauncey Billups. Do we really know Chauncey Billups? Like, we find out more and more things about him, and then people start to go, eh, you know, well, Chauncey liked to gamble or whatever. But so you find that stuff out. So for the rest of us, just another cautionary reminder of, hey, maybe we don't know these people all that well, and maybe we shouldn't elevate them to the pedestal of genius status because they're winning some football games or they're playing well on the court, or, you know, maybe we should pause a little bit and be like, hey, they're really good at what they do and they're skilled at what they do, but they're also human. And if you give them a long enough chance to show you that they're human, they're going to show you that they're human. And I think about that right now, especially as it pertains to Dan Lanning at Oregon. There's a lot of the narrative around Lanning is just everything that he does right and how great he is and what a good family guy he is. And that's true. All that stuff may be true. But as we drill down, like, you know, we don't really know Dan Lanning in the way that, like, his parents know him. And it's why, you know, I kind of reached out when he first got the job at Oregon. I reached out to his mom and dad. And I know, you know, I'm still in contact with Dan Lanning's mom and dad. His dad texted me on Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving. And, you know, and it happened to be his birthday, by the way. His dad, Dan Lanning's dad's, Don, was born on Thanksgiving. And so I'm more interested in kind of knowing them through the eyes of their parents or their siblings or the kids they grew up with. And not so much just what they want us to know about them now. Now that they're working in the real world. And I'm not saying Dan Lanning's a bad guy. I'm just saying, let's pump the brakes a little bit on, he's a genius. He's amazing. Same with Jamarcus Shepherd at Oregon State. Like, great introductory news conference. Got off to a good start. I can remember other coaches who won the news conference out of the gates who ended up not being very good at their jobs. So I'm not saying he's not going to be good at his job. Don't at me. But I'm just saying, maybe we pump the brakes a little bit on anointing, you know, and holding a coronation prematurely. It happened at USC with Lincoln Riley. People might remember there was the marching band and the cheerleaders and the athletic director, Mike Bone, declaring that it was a new era, that they had changed the landscape of college athletics simply with one move, with one hire. And the USC fans immediately were like, we're going to win multiple conference championships in the Pac-12. And I wrote a column after that. And I said, look, pump the brakes on this a little bit. You know, there's some programs in the Pac-12 like Washington and Oregon and Utah that had had some real success and had great culture. And, you know, suddenly bringing Lincoln Riley to USC, I didn't think it was going to change that. It was going to help USC potentially, but it wasn't going to change those other things. The other cautionary tale here is for the people in those positions. I just cannot believe, like, it's not Sharon Moore. He's not alone. I mean, you look back and you can find historically cases of people who have it made, they have it set. They have risen to the highest level of their profession. Chauncey Billups coaching the Blazers, making $5-6 million a year. Suddenly he's, you know, the subject of an FBI investigation in the Department of Justice. Sharon Moore is coaching at Michigan. He's got one of the best, three or four jobs in America, set up for success, winning 9 games. And you look at the unraveling of his personal life and the events of the last 24 hours, and it's just mind-blowing to see. It's almost like Aesop's fables, to see the rise and the fall of some of these characters in sport. And Tiger Woods is a tale as well. I mean, remember when Tiger had to sit out and apologize for the transgressions of his personal life, and now he's, you know, he had a bad back after that and health problems, but it was almost like these infallible athletes who had risen to the greatest levels of their sport lacked logic in the end and lacked rationale in the end. Great cautionary tale there as well. We've got a great show for you today. Dana Altman's coming up, University of Oregon men's basketball coach. He's got a big Northwest Elite Showcase event coming up on December 21st against Gonzaga. So what? We're 10 days away from Oregon and Gonzaga playing in this Northwest Elite Showcase, which is going to be a really different kind of event. You know, I've talked about it quite a bit this week, but essentially this showdown between Gonzaga and Oregon, which typically doesn't happen, will be taking place at Moda Center Sunday the 21st, 3 o'clock. There's some tickets still available at Ticketmaster. I think they're expecting a nice crowd. You know, I talked with some of the people involved with it. 10 or 12,000 is what they're expecting inside Moda Center. It'll be a nice crowd. Chance for people in Portland in the run-up to Christmas. Take a break from the shopping and go see a basketball game. But Dana Ullman's got to get things right with his program. He has struggled this season. He is sounding yet again like a guy who is ready to hang it up. Or maybe, you know, we said this last year. We said it last year at the end of the season. We were like, you know what? You know, this team underachieved. And then what happened? They flipped the switch and played really well down the stretch, made the NCAA tournament, and rattled around a little bit. And so does Dana Ullman see that for this team? Does he see it forming in the horizon? And where is he as it pertains to kind of all the talk about NIL and the portal? And does he want to just get back to coaching? You know, how does the coach at Oregon navigate all that? Dana Ullman coming up. We'll have more in the 4 o'clock hour as well on college football playoff and what should be done to the bowl season. Carl Benson will be joining us, the former WAC commissioner, former Sun Belt commissioner. Fun event going on today and tomorrow. Kind of the soft launch today, and really we'll go full throttle tomorrow. But the Baldfaced Truth Foundation helps kids in art, music, education, and athletics. If you're a longtime listener to the show, you know that that nonprofit, that 501c3, was born on this show. Really belongs to you as an audience. And every year we kind of do a late in the year fundraising event. We include some Blazers tickets. We have Blazers courtside seats that are up for auction. We have the Hillsboro Hops allowing somebody to throw out a first pitch at a Hops baseball game up for auction. The good friends at Shoe Mill have donated a VIP shoe adventure that would make a fantastic Christmas gift for the lady in your life. We have also a number of other, like a fishing expedition. We have, you know, if you want to play on the BFT Foundation Celebrity Golf Tournament, we've got an auction lot that features a foursome there. Bill Shonley, the late, great Bill Shonley, the mayor of Rip City, he once upon a time recorded a CD, Christmas version CD, for the BFT Foundation, including a bunch of hits like 'Twas the Night Before Christmas and others. We've got those CDs available as well. You can go to BFTauction.com. If you want to see those auction items now, and then throughout tomorrow's show, really, we'll start ramping up and talking more about the auction items. But that stuff is open and live now if you want to check it out at bftauction.com. Leave it here. Dana Ullman coming up.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
University of Oregon basketball coach Dana Ullman joining us now. Coach, let's start by talking about, you know, how does your day start? Do you have a routine in the morning that you start with? Is it a cup of coffee? Is it a newspaper? Is it a walk? What do you do in the morning?
Well, it's usually more than one cup of coffee. I'm not a real good sleeper, so no, it starts with two or three cups. Try to get going a little bit. Sit with my wife and discuss the day a little bit, and then just head to the office. So it's pretty much a routine every day.
Does it help to kind of start your day not talking basketball? Like if you talk about, you know, the news of the day or whatever's on your wife's mind that day or what she's doing, does it help to kind of have that refocusing of there's a world going on outside of basketball?
Absolutely. You know, I try not to bring all my troubles home and you know, Reva every now and then wants to talk a little basketball, but mostly we talk about the family, the grandkids, you know, what's going on, the events, but we don't talk a lot of basketball, which I do appreciate.
Dana Ullman, University of Oregon men's basketball coach, our guest. All right, three grandkids. I know they're younger, but would you want to coach them someday? Would that be something Grandpa would want to do? I mean, they're like 4 and 6 years old. Those I think the two of them in there. But how, would you ever want to be their coach on a youth basketball team or a young basketball team?
I would. I'd love to do that. I don't know if they'd want me around. You know, that'd be the second part of that question. But to answer your question, I'd love to do that. I'd, you know, love to spend time with them and coach their little teams. That'd be great.
This season, you know, it's been tough, and I think you went through a spell like this last year where, you know, it was probably felt like a grind, but last year you ended up figuring it out and your guys figured it out and you played some really good basketball down the stretch. Do you foresee that? Can you see that coming? Did you see that coming last year as the season was going on?
No, last year, you know, we had a very old group, mature group, you know, with great leadership, TJ Bamba, Brandon Angel, Keyshawn, you know, those guys were really focused. You know, this year, you know, our guys want to do it. We just, you know, excuses. We've been banged up at key spots, you know, Jackson not getting started, you know, the first 6 weeks of the season. Nate's been banged up now, missed, you know, three games, and KJ missed the last one. You know, those are three guys we're really depending on because of their experience, and especially here early in the season, they know how we want to play. And so we've really had trouble executing our offense. We've really had trouble, you know, getting defensively. The communication has been really poor. And because of that, we've given up a lot of easy baskets. And, you know, we're not near where we should be at this point in time. And to get there, we need to get everybody healthy. We've had practice all week, but most of the guys have been out. It was one of those weeks I was really hoping that we could make some progress, but Nate continues to be nagged by an ankle. KJ's been out because he's still sick. Jackson missed yesterday's practice. Dev's been out all week with the groin. So it's, you know, it's a work in progress, but I think the first step is trying to get everybody healthy and then try to get everybody on the same page execution-wise offensively, and our communication just has to improve defensively to get some stops.
All right. You mentioned about, you know, sort of the communication on the defensive side. I've heard coaches talk about that. How do you get young players to talk? Because sometimes when they're out there playing, they go quiet for some reason. How do you really get them to communicate and talk, especially in a loud arena where, you know, that really helps a team when it comes to team defense?
It's always been a problem, but, you know, I've noticed in the last, you know, 7-8 years, I think it's been even more so. You know, the guys communicate so much with text messages. You know, we used to go to restaurants and, you know, the problem was to keep them quiet, you know, because we'd get in there and everybody start talking. Now it's trying to get them to talk. You know, we go to a restaurant to have a team meal and they all look at their phones all meal, you know, and, so it's really become a different and a bigger problem to get guys to communicate on the floor and talk. It helps if you have a couple alpha dogs that, you know, really want to dominate. And, you know, back when we had Dylan Brooks and Dylan Ennis and Jordan Bell in that group, one of the reasons, you know, our defense was always in the top 20 back then, they just communicated so well. And we had a bunch of talkers. You know, Brooks was talking all the time. Dylan Ennis was talking all the time. Jordan Bell was talking all the time. We had a bunch of guys that really enjoyed, you know, communicating on the defensive end, getting stops. And it was, they took a lot of pride in it. You know, most of the guys now, we just getting them to talk. And I don't know if they're afraid to make a mistake, you know, but if you're decisive and you tell your teammates what you're doing, you know, it sets a tone and everybody can play off that. And you get into problems when you don't talk and you're not decisive and two guys are going to the same guy, or, you know, you mess up your ball screen coverage. So communication is really important. Covers up a lot of mistakes that you can make on the defensive end. And obviously, we're not doing that right now.
Everybody talks about offense, and I know young players like to focus on how many points they got, how many rebounds they got. How do you get young people to buy into defense?
That, too, has become a little more difficult. because of, you know, the media, everybody focuses on the points. Their parents always have, their girlfriends always have. But now we got agents involved, and they're focused in on it. So we added another layer to the equation of everybody worried about how many shots they're getting, how many points they're getting. You know, it's a game that involves defense, which everybody knows travels. And, you know, the ball doesn't always go in, but defensively you can always put in great effort. The boards. And then the offense, it's three phases, and you have to be good in all three. You know, there are not many Final Four teams or Elite Eight teams that aren't in the top 30 defensively. And, you know, offense is a big part of the game. You got to score buckets, but there's a lot of different ways to win games, and some nights that ball just doesn't go in. But defensive effort, defensive communication, effort on the boards, those things you can – you can control those a little bit more than you can control whether that three ball's going in any particular night.
Coach, the you know, the buy-in that you get, you mentioned agents, and you know, I cringed when you said that, because I go, this is I don't know if I'll ever be comfortable with that in college basketball. But how much do you have to deal with it, and how big a headache is that?
Well, you know, big part of coaching is trust. And, you know, I really admire our football staff. You know, I go over there and spend a lot of time. You know, I used to. Now that our season started. But, you know, the trust that our football team has in our coaching staff. And, you know, coaching is such a big part of trust. And, you know, the players got to trust me, you know. And if they're hearing a lot of different voices, you know, it makes that trust harder to establish. And, you know, big part of coaching is getting the guys to do things they're not comfortable with, things that aren't fun, things that they may not get rewarded for. And to do those things, the players really got to trust you. You know, they got to know that you have their back and that you have their best interest. And, you know, the things that you're doing will lead to success, not only collectively, but for them individually. And the agents add just another layer to that. And so it has been an adjustment, John, over the last few years, trying to, you know, get guys to really believe in what we're talking about, especially when you have guys coming in for 1 year, yeah, 2 years. You know, our Final Four team, we had, you know, Dylan was with us for 3 years, Jordan Bell for 3 years, Casey for 3 years, you know, Peyton was just a freshman, but, you know, all the guys on that team had been around for a while and, you know, kind of had a belief in us. And that's been really the case with, you know, our Sweet 16 teams and the teams that have had a little bit more success.
Dana Altman with us, Oregon basketball coach. December 21st, 3 o'clock in Portland, Moda Center. It'll be Gonzaga and you guys on the court. You know, tickets are available at Ticketmaster for people who want to go. What's that going to be like for you guys to have that game in sort of a neutral site, but really kind of a home game, and play a Gonzaga program that, you know, you've not seen regularly in the regular season?
No, Mark does a great job, and, you know, they'll have a lot of fans there, and I hope our fans are excited about a game in Portland. I know Jackson and, you know, Drew Carter and Luke Johnson, we got some guys from Portland that are excited to go play. But, you know, it's a big game for us. Gonzaga's playing really well. We got to get things straightened out here in the next 10 days to be ready for that game, you know, and hopefully we'll be healthy. But Mark does a great job. They're playing really well. And, you know, I've always appreciated their consistency, you know, with their program and all they've. They play in a much different league than we do. They're very consistent. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we'll be healthy and playing a lot better. But we do look forward to the challenge. And it will be a big challenge. They're good inside. You know, their guards are steady. And when they shoot threes well, they're really tough, you know. And Michigan, their one loss is, you know, when Michigan gets it going right now, they're so much further ahead than most teams. that they're really a handful. So we know that it'll be a tough, tough game for us. We're going to have to play really well. But we are looking forward to the challenge.
Yeah, this will be a game that obviously is not being promoted by a traditional promoter. And the proceeds from the game will go to Gonzaga and go to Oregon. And that has to feel a little bit good. Like there's a business there where, you know, potentially your program will receive some benefit from.
No, that is a big part of it. You know, we're in a two-year agreement with Gonzaga. We're going to play in Seattle either next year or the following year, whichever works out best for both our schedules. You know, and both gates are going to be split. So it is a different type of game, something that's becoming more commonplace with the NIL and everything. So, yes, it is a different thing. The two programs will benefit greatly from the attendance.
All right, Coach, I appreciate you making time for us. We'll see you at Moda Center on 10 days from now, December 21st, 3 o'clock, Gonzaga and Oregon mixing it up. Thanks for your time, Coach. Appreciate you.
All righty, John. Take care.
All right, take care. And there he goes, University of Oregon basketball coach Dana Altman with a very unusual game that is taking place on December 21. That game will be at Moda Center, 3 o'clock tip. It will be Mark Few and Gonzaga against Dana Altman and the University of Oregon in what should be a fun showcase. And again, like the background of this event, it's kind of cool. Like the promoters, like generally with a game like this, where you have this non-conference game that happens, is you have like promoters who are, you know, going to roll their sleeves up and do the promotional work and sell the game to TV. And then what are they going to do? They're going to end up recouping their investment and then some, because they are able to, you know, go out and collect the ticket gate and keep it for themselves and keep that TV money for themselves and sell sponsorships of the event. And there's work involved. There's sweat equity involved in that promotion game. I'm not knocking it. But generally, the schools are just paid, you know, hey, you're going to get $50,000 or $100,000 to come play in this game. The difference with this Northwest Elite Showdown, this two-year series that Altman mentioned, is kind of the financial structure of the game and how the money's going to be distributed. You know, you're going to have Oregon and Gonzaga playing in this game, but Oregon and Gonzaga essentially are the promoters of the game. They're going to split the proceeds with television revenue. They're going to split the proceeds with sponsorship dollars. They're going to split the gate. And they'll walk away with a much larger payout. The money that is gathered from this will help fund NIL in basketball and potentially some other sports at the University of Oregon. And Gonzaga will take their half and distribute it in their NIL ecosystem. And everybody will walk away better for it. Is this the future? Is this the blueprint? Is this the model to be determined? Because I think what we still need to see is we still need to see how successful it can be. I know the ticket sales are solid. You know, they're expecting 10 or 12,000 fans at Moda Center. That's great. They were never, I don't think, ever anticipating a sellout of the building. But they have, you know, they have various price levels. You can get down, you can still buy, you know, courtside seats for this thing. You can buy seats that are up a little further, a little cheaper, get you just the get-in price. But, you know, I'm really curious to see how it works out, because the entrepreneurial side of this, you know, is interesting to me. I find it fascinating that there's the potential for Oregon and Gonzaga and maybe Oregon State and others someday to kind of make this part of their business model. Hour number two still ahead, where we'll talk with Carl Benson, the former WAC and Sun Belt commissioner. Plus, coming up next, we're going to talk about the cost of being a sports fan. It's getting out of hand, isn't it? It's time.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I was talking to a diehard Oregon Ducks fan yesterday. This guy has been going to Oregon football games for 31 seasons. He's a graduate of the University of Oregon. He's got three season tickets, Section 34, Row 61, Autzen Stadium. This is not club level. This is not VIP level. This is a normal nice seat inside Autzen Stadium on the south side of the stadium. Three season tickets. The cost for his tickets and parking for the entire season is about $2,400. $2,400, $800 per seat. He is excited that Oregon is hosting James Madison coming up on December 20th at Autzen Stadium, opening round of the playoff. He showed me his ticket invoice for the CFP opening round game. Tickets are $270 each, 270. Total cost for three seats plus parking for that first round CFP game is $913. $913 to see Oregon James Madison in the opening round. And he told me, he said, hey, we're not going to do it. We're not going to pay it. It's not going to be part of what we do. And he obviously is going to stay home and watch the game on TV, not pay the $913. It literally got me thinking about a column that I wrote a few months ago about the rising cost of being a diehard sports fan. I almost feel like these leagues that have been hyper interested in growth. You see the NFL going into Europe. You see the college games being played in Ireland. You see, you know, more and more wider, cast the net wider. Hey, we need new fans. I think they've done a really good job of trying to have wide appeal. But the other thing they've done is they have done a deft job of drilling into the wallets of the P1 sports fan and wringing every possible dollar out of those wallets. $119.99 to stream MLB games. NFL Sunday ticket for $276 on YouTube, Paramount, Amazon Prime, Sling TV, Hulu Sports Package, ESPN Plus, Peacock, whatever else. It really got me thinking about the cost. A New York Times op-ed piece that was written a few months ago called it the mining of fandom. Pro sports teams and colleges that used to operate like civic institutions that would have their games on public TV, widely available, full distribution, almost like it was, like PBS. They used to operate like that, have now gone full throttle in private pursuit of revenue. Now, Jun Lee, who was the writer of that New York Times op-ed piece, confessed that he subscribes to nearly every sports offering that's out there, including YouTube TV, MLB TV, NBA League Pass, NFL Sunday Ticket. He had a Peacock subscription, Apple TV Plus, Max, Amazon Prime, Paramount. His annual cost for all of those subscriptions, $2,634, $2,700. The same amount of money that the Duck fan is paying to go to season tickets next season for three seats at Autzen Stadium is what this guy's paying to watch games on TV. Now, again, it's worth noting that the University of Oregon is not setting the playoff ticket prices. They're not collecting revenue from the tickets. The money goes to the CFP itself. It gets pooled with television and licensing dollars and eventually gets distributed among the beneficiaries. Oregon only gets to recoup its game day costs. The fan I spoke with did not see the value in spending what is about a third of what he pays for season tickets to see one game in which Oregon is a 22-point favorite. And I doubt he's going to go to the Orange Bowl or the Peach Bowl or the CFP title game should it come to that for Oregon. Last season, before the kickoff of the national title game in Atlanta, I walked down from the press box and I stood on the railing above the main concourse and I could see down and I could watch the Notre Dame and Ohio State fans who were kind of milling around the concourse. There were some blue-collar fans in there, but it was not lost on me that the cost of tickets and travel is a barrier. There's a financial exhaustion factor that's in play here. The Buckeyes last year had just played in the Rose Bowl and the Cotton Bowl. Notre Dame had played in the Orange Bowl and the Sugar Bowl. The national, and plus they had a first-round game, and the national title game at Mercedes-Benz Stadium was the third road trip in 19 days for both fan bases. Until this week, I had not even considered the additional cost of playing the opening round game, which is, you know, another $900 for this fan, take his family. On the morning of the national title game in Atlanta, I sat in the lobby of my hotel. Crowd was buzzing. Buckeye fans were eager. Irish fans were tense. But mostly what I noted was the crowd was a little uppity. It looked like, the afternoon ferry crowd going out to Martha's Vineyard. And, you know, I talked recently with Teresa Gold, who is a member of the College Football Playoff Management Committee. The Pac-12 commissioner is part of that committee. They oversee the operation of the tournament. And I told her that last year's title game felt like it was trying to be the Super Bowl. And she said, you know, you're right. Like, they're mining untapped assets right now, looking for more money. The marketing push on that game was evident. The sponsors were everywhere. The discussion in that group now is like, how do we get more money out of this? How do we squeeze more money out of it? And here's the thing. They're not going to go out and find new fans. What they're doing is they're drilling down on current sponsors and current fans. Yesterday on the show, or 2 days ago on the show, we had Amy Perko, the CEO of Knight Commission. She talked about the buyouts, the excessive coaching buyouts, growing number of schools paying fired coaches, big spending, clear symptom of a broken financial model for football. You know, all these things, all these leagues and these teams and these schools are in a race for resources. We know that. At the same time, they don't want to turn off their customer. Their customer is now being asked to pay more for tickets, fund the NIL operation, pay, extra for parking. And now here comes some extra games. And oh, by the way, what TV packages do you have? You better have them all. Otherwise, you're going to miss some of the other games. I'm really worried about the way that college football is treating its primary consumer. Because I think it's one thing to identify an untapped asset and to try to monetize it. It is another to systematically squeeze your fan base into poverty. What's the old saying? It's the duty of a good shepherd to shear the sheep, not to skin them. Duck fan that I talked with is having the time of his life. His team is the number 5 seed in the bracket. He works a good job. He makes a good living. He drives a Kia. He said, I save money there so I could spend on my season tickets. But this postseason game is not in the budget for his family, not at $270 a ticket plus parking. If it were Alabama or Oklahoma against Oregon, maybe he would go. Or Notre Dame, he would go. Maybe he would splurge for it. But he's got a budget to keep, and James Madison, it doesn't move the needle for him. I don't think he's going to be alone. I do worry about fans out there. I worry about you. I worry about what you're paying when you go to the stadium. I'm worried that families are getting priced out. I'm worried that, you know, there's some kids that are not going to be able to go to the stadium and see games like they used to in the old days. I worry about, like, you know, all the subscription services you have to watch the games on TV. It is unquestionable that college athletics is, tapping into fans and tapping into the wallets of fans in a way they've never done before. It's not like they're looking for new customers right there. Now, they're not trying to grow the game. They're going, hey, who are our pre-1 customers? Who's already at the stadium? Can we get more money out of these people? Can we squeeze them a little harder? Can we ask them to not only to pay more for their tickets so that we can share more revenue with our athletes, to help us pay the buyouts of the coaches, to help us cover our expenses, trying to win, but now also, by the way, we're going to the playoffs, and guess what? Congratulations, home playoff game. Here comes the bill, and guess who's paying that bill? Fans are paying the bill, and it's not Oregon's fault. It's happening all around the country. All these teams that are hosting or playing first-round playoff games, they're all seeing the same ticket price. It's that $270 ticket just to be in the stadium in a decent seat. End zone seats are like $155. It's just not cheap to go to the game. And you know what? They'll probably sell it out. So people will probably tell me, hey, Canzano, what are you complaining about? The market doesn't lie. You always say that if they sell these tickets, that means that there's a market and there's a demand for it. And why shouldn't they go get that demand? Well, part of the why is I wonder at the end what you're doing to your consumer. I wonder about the exhaustion. I wonder how many Duck fans really will, you know, in the old days, they used to make the trip to the Rose Bowl, but how many fans really will try to go on the road with the team to an Orange Bowl and then a Peach Bowl and then a national championship game? And, you know, what ends up being the end result of that? I am concerned. I am concerned about the strain that's putting on families. I'm concerned about what that's doing to sports fans. I'm concerned about the lack of respect that it shows for fans in general. And again, this is not an Oregon thing. I am not singling out the University of Oregon. This happened last year with all these fan bases that traveled in the playoff. It's happening even at Oregon State, Washington State, and in the Pac-12, where they're all going, hey, we got to raise our ticket prices. We need to charge more. We need to get more out of our existing fan base instead of trying to grow the game. Because what is not happening right now is I don't see real growth of the game. People will hold up TV ratings, like for the Ohio State-Indiana Big Ten championship game. It was a huge number. You know, almost 20 million people watching a football game. And they'll say, look, the game is really healthy. No, it kind of tells me that, you know, there was a big demand for Ohio State. A lot of people wanted to see that. Tells me, too, that when you have a prime matchup, you sure can sell it, and you can ring everything you possibly can get out of it. But I also kind of look at that, and I go to myself, and I say, okay, they have 20 million people watching from home, but will these people, will they show up to the stadiums? Are we headed to an era that is like horse racing, where the explosion of paramutual online horse wagering killed attendance at the track? Pretty soon nobody was going to the track. Everybody was watching it going, we don't have to be at the track. We can wager from watching it on closed circuit TV or watching it from the comfort of our living room and wagering on it. There is something lost when you start to limit the accessibility of games. And I'm not saying a CFP game is in everyone, should be in everyone's budget. It's a special thing. But I am saying I'm worried in general. The cost of those $2,300 or $2,400 season tickets this year at Oregon, they're going up to $2,700 next year. Where will they be in 5 years? Who will be in the stadium? Who can afford to go to these games anymore? We got a great show for you. Stick around. The bald-faced truth coming at you. And all this part today, part of our big radiothon that isn't really a radiothon. You can go online right now to bftauction.com if you want to check out the auction items. Begin to place bids. This will be going on today and tomorrow on the BFT radio show. Hour two is coming up. Stick around.
BFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
I talked about this on yesterday's show, but this morning, I took a private flight out of PDX. And I must say, Stephen, if you've never had a chance to travel on a private aircraft, you should try it sometime. It's not bad. It's not a bad thing to not have to go into the airport, go through the security. Definitely, there was a little Beverly Hillbillies in my act, though, this morning, because I didn't know. What can I bring? Can I bring a bag? Can I bring a carry-on plus one personal item? Turns out you just come as you are. But I want to thank, it was the Rotary Club and the Sports Association in Yakima, Washington, flew me this morning over to their luncheon that they do on Thursdays and talked to a crowd. It was a lively crowd, and there's nothing like live performance in front of a lively crowd. I had a good time with it. I'll talk more about it coming up, but I highly recommend it. You had a chance to get on somebody else's private plane. They wanted to fly me over. They didn't want to do Zoom. And I don't mind that. If you have a chance to get on somebody else's plane, Stephen, you go and you do it, okay? I want you to know that right now. Get after it. Our next guest is the former commissioner of the WAC and the Sun Belt. I'm going to guess Carl Benson's been on a few private planes. As the commissioner in those conferences, Carl Benson, did you travel via private aircraft?
First of all, I got to remember, John, the third one that sometimes you forget, and that's the good old Mid-American Conference.
So, oh, there you go. There you go.
Add a third to my 30-year career as a commissioner, which I'm very proud of. Yes, I was on occasion on a private plane or two, not as many as some of my colleagues in the Big Ten or the SEC, but it is nice, and especially when you don't have to pay for it. And I was surprised to hear that you were in Yakima, Washington. Back when I lived in Yakima as a grade schooler, we pronounce it Yakima. They now pronounce it Yakima.
Yakima.
In honor of the Yakima tribe and the Yakima reservation. So that had to be a pretty cool thing for you.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool to get in there. And anytime a group is excited to hear you talk about sports or, and sports used to be such a diversion. And now, in a lot of ways, it's a downer. It can be a drag. And so just to see the passion in the room. And, I have to think, as a commissioner, you were one of the guardians of the sport at one time. And you're watching what's happening now. Help us with the bowl season. If we can start in any place, I think the bowl season would be a good place to start. Carl Benson, I put you in charge of fixing the college football bowl season. What are you doing?
Eliminate the weekly rankings. It just is doing no one any real value you know, except ESPN, and I'm sure those passionate fans in Yakima like to debate it. So the fans like it, the network likes it, ESPN likes it, but I think that it's damaging right now in light of the rankings this last week. Now, you know, I say that as part of the postseason. The overall bowl system, I think, continues to be healthier than maybe what's advertised. It's been reorganized. It's under a good structure called the bowl season now. And as someone whose teams valued those bowl opportunities, I don't think I ever heard a coach talk about a meaningless football bowl game. So, and as Lavelle Edwards, the old BYU coach, said many times, I've never been to a bad bowl game.
The group of five schools, they've got a path into the playoff, and you know, and I think they would litigate to keep that if it ever came to it. But what should they do beyond that? If beyond the one or two schools that are going to get into this playoff every now and then, what do the rest of the group of five and group of six? What can they do to maybe monetize their own postseason or create opportunities?
I know there's a conversation being done by the, you know, the five commissioners, six commissioners, counting the Pac-12 commissioner, that talks about what can they do, and a separate, you know, postseason is beyond their agenda. I don't think there's consensus right now. I've talked to at least two commissioners in the group who would favor a playoff, some type of a playoff system for themselves. Especially if it perhaps led into the spot, determining the spot in the, you know, in the CFP playoffs. So I think there's various models that could be done. It would have an impact on the traditional bowl season, perhaps, if not only were there 12 Power Four teams taken out of the bowl system, but now you take the, you know, the four or five champions out of the group of five into some type of a playoff. So that would probably damage the bowl system a little bit. But I know it's on the agenda. I know that they're looking at it. I know too, though, John, that the opportunity, the access that you mentioned into the playoff, now that there is a legitimate 12-team playoff, soon to be 14, 16, I think we can be assured that it's going to be larger than 12. You know, they still want to have that access, you know, the same type of access that they have in the NCAA basketball tournament, in terms of starting the season, you know, with their teams, with their fan bases, with their loyal constituencies, that they truly have a chance to, you know, to play for, you know, a national championship. And you know, Boise State last year, my alma mater, when they went to the Fiesta Bowl to play Penn State, their fans, you know, honestly believed that they had a chance to win a national championship. And, you know, Tulane and James Madison now, those fans and those teams are going there. They're not going to pick up a paycheck. They're going to try to win, you know, win games against Ole Miss and Oregon and advance on into the next round. And so that's really, really important. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be around the table, you know, back in 1997, you know, almost 30 years ago now, when access was given to the, you know, to the group of five for participation in, you know, what was the Bowl Alliance and the Bowl Championship Series, the BCS, and then the CFP, and now the, you know, the playoff system. And it's always been an important access point, and that access point has changed from 1997, from being a performance based, where it was if you're in the top six, then it went to if you're in the top 12, and each time teams have met that threshold on various levels, to today, now it's a guaranteed spot to the, you know, to the highest ranked. And you know, I believe that there will continue to be hopefully the same access in terms of some type of a guarantee. But I think that there's also a time when you could argue that it needs to be based on performance. And the Group of Five, over the years, you go back and look at the times that those teams, starting with, you know, with the Utah back in 2004, when, you know, they had one of those great seasons playing in the Mountain West, you know, going undefeated and getting the opportunity to, you know, to play in the Fiesta Bowl in 2004 and winning that game. And then it was another 12 years before Boise State, you know, had their opportunity to play Oklahoma in the Fiesta Bowl, you know, and they've won those games. And you know, I did a little look back, and there've been 19 games, you know, over time with Group of Five participants, including last year's Boise State into the playoff, you know, and the Group of Five had won 10 out of those 19 games over time. Group of Five membership has changed since then. Seven teams that were part of it, Utah, TCU, BYU, SMU, Central Florida, Cincinnati, Houston, are no longer Group of Five. They're you know, Power Four, so the membership has changed. And I think that the challenges for the Group of Five now to deliver like those teams previously, whether it was Utah or Boise State, TCU, UCF, obviously, Houston, Cincinnati, all those teams that pulled the wins. Even remember, Tulane beat Southern Cal most recently in 2022, in one of those bowl games. So, or one of those New Year's Day games. So I think that the Group of Five has proven that they belong on the big stage. And it's just, how do they get there? How do they stay there? And there was pressure last year on Boise State to deliver. They performed, you know, against Penn State. And I think there's tremendous pressure now on Tulane and James Madison to maintain the credibility of the Group of Five.
Carl Benson with us. He's been the commissioner of three Group of Five conferences, including the WAC, Sun Belt, and the MAC, the Mid-American Conference. You know, you used to walk into those rooms, and you'd walk in, and you'd see the SEC and the Big Ten commissioner, back in the day, the Pac-12 commissioner. How did they treat you? How did, you know, when you walk into that room, did they treat you with dignity, or did you have the feeling like they always said, oh, we're the Power Five, and you're not, as you walked into those conversations in those rooms?
It was a lot funner after Boise State beat Oklahoma. and there was a little bit of recognition. And, you know, I remember, you know, after that, at a meeting, an annual meeting with all of the 10 commissioners at the time, the meeting was interrupted, and representatives from Fox Sports walked into the room with a trophy that they gave to me and to Boise State for, you know, the game of the year in terms of the Boise State win over Oklahoma. You know, probably one of my proudest moments to be in that room and to have that type of an accolade. So it, you know, it helps when you have credibility. And I mean, that room has changed now, though, tremendously from, you know, you look at the commissioners, and it's, you know, it's Greg Sankey and John Steinbrecher and Judy McLeod are the only ones that are still there that were there when I was around the table. But, you know, people talk about whether there's still that camaraderie around the table. I think that it has lessened, and it's not just within the FBS conferences. I think it's all 32 Division I conferences. There just isn't that same, just the loyalty and the camaraderie around the table. It probably has lessened over the course of the last several years.
Carl, if you were giving advice to Teresa Gold, the Pac-12 commissioner, where should her focus be as the New World Pac-12 launches and begins a football season next year?
You know, I think that you know, she has the foundation, and she has the teams, you know, under the Pac-12 umbrella, that can go out and win those big games and can continue the kind of the tradition of the Group of Five. I know that no one likes that term, the Group of Five and the separation, and I know that whether it's the Pac-12 or the American or Sun Belt Conference USA or MAC or Mountain West, you know, everyone wants to be the best of that group and forge their way into whatever might be a new system down the road. But I think she's done a wonderful job of putting the right teams around the table. And I think that it's certainly, you know, a promotional piece that they've got to go out and, you know, and win next year in that first year of the Pac-12 and to set the stage and to put the stake in the ground and say, you know, we are the best. And, you know, I think that the Pac-12 name by itself will help that cause and will help that effort to continue it. So, you know, you grew up as a Pac-8, Pac-10, Pac-12. I grew up in the state of Washington. You know, talk about Yakima. I'm sure that you ran into both Husky fans and Cougar fans in Yakima, Washington.
Duck fans, and everything. Oregon State fans.
Yeah, big time. Yeah. It's a big, you know, college football state. And so I'm rooting for the Pac-12, that's for sure. And I'll continue to – I was born in Oregon and raised in Washington, so I've got a lot of roots in the Pac-12.
All right, you're hitting on something because I was in this room and, you know, it was a nice crowd and they all wore their jersey of their favorite team. And you're right, there were Husky fans, there were Duck fans, there were Cougar fans, there were Beaver fans, there were Stanford and Army and Navy fans and Notre Dame fans in the room. How, like, who's looking out for the fan these days? Because I keep talking about the greater good and, you know, the conference commissioners will say, yeah, we care about the greater good, but we also need to negotiate what's best for our conference. Is there anybody in your mind, Carl, that is looking out for the greater good of college athletics and college football specifically?
You know, that for 100 years was supposed to be the NCAA. And, you know, the past several years now, in light of the legal challenges and the role that television is playing, that the NCAA has lost some of that oversight and some of that governance. I still think it's there. I hope it can be regained. Commissioners now need to take that role within their own conferences. You know, I think that Teresa has hit on some in terms of the scheduling of the Pac-12 football games for next year, knowing in advance. I mean, I have friends who are longtime Cougar season ticket holders and longtime Husky season ticket holders, and their biggest gripe was those 8 o'clock games in Seattle or Pullman when they had to, you know, either drive to Olympia or drive from Pullman to Spokane or whatever. And I think that, you know, that there has been a recognition that there needs to be some real direct correlation between your fan base and how convenient it is to get to and from their games.
Notre Dame's athletic director, Pete Bebakwa, went after Jim Phillips of the ACC. For people who don't know Jim Phillips, I mean, his reputation as being sort of a unifier and an upstanding person, I think, precedes him, walks into the room in front of him in some ways. Give us an idea. Was Notre Dame's AD out of line here, Carl, or was he right to go after the ACC a little bit?
You know, we probably, when I say we, commissioners in general, all have had disgruntled athletic directors and presidents and fans that have attacked us and questioned our integrity. And it's a tough one to accept. You hope that it's not longstanding and that apologies can be made. But, you know, the old adage, you know, families don't air their dirty laundry, you know, outside of the family has kind of normally been something that we all want to try to adhere to. And this certainly went viral. And Jim Phillips, as I've known him for 20 years or more, he handled it in a professional, you know, very, very professional way. And, you know, again, ADs, you know, have changed over time too, that the, you know, the characteristics of ADs, their background, they're not familiar with how college sports operates and manages. So was he out of line? You know, I'd say that he probably wishes that he could take back what he said.
The, you know, Brett Yormark came to his defense
Jim Phillips' defense. You know, you've seen the Big 12 and the ACC sort of align themselves. Here's what Yarmark said publicly about Notre Dame's athletic director.
I will say this, and I'm a little outspoken about it. I don't like how Notre Dame's reacted to it.
So,
okay, I think Pete's his behavior has been egregious. It's been egregious going after Jim Phillips when they saved Notre Dame during COVID. We all knew, and it was very transparent. Hunter was very transparent about it, the chair, that as Notre Dame and Miami got closer together, head-to-head would be a factor. Okay? BYU lost. They became closer together. Head-to-head made a difference in that decision. So I think he is totally out of bounds in his approach, and if he was in the room, I'd tell him the same thing.
All right, you've been a commissioner. Tell us what we're hearing there. Is that the Big 12, who has, in a lot of ways, been in partnership with the ACC, backing each other, or is that just Yarmark being Yarmark?
Yeah, I don't know, Brent, but I respect the fact that he has been outspoken, you know, throughout his tenure, and he's not afraid to say something out of the room or inside the room. But again, I don't know what purpose it necessarily provides. It was a tough bitter pill to swallow, and there've been a lot of other teams. I mean, 2 years ago at this time, you know, Florida State gets the rug pulled out from under them. In 1996, I had the rug pulled out from under me when BYU got snubbed and didn't go to the Fiesta Bowl, which really changed all this that we were talking about early on in terms of access for the Group of Five. I mean, it landed me testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, reading from a prepared script that legal counsel provided, knowing that what I was about to say, you know, possibly could have ruined my career when I accused, you know, Roy Kramer, the commissioner of the SEC, and Jim Delaney, the commissioner of the Big Ten, of, you know, conspiracy that they kept BYU out of the Fiesta Bowl. And did I continue a friendship and a relationship with, you know, with Roy and Jim? Absolutely. I was with Jim last month at his place in North Carolina playing golf. Roy Kramer came to the WAC summer meetings 1 year to talk about what it means to be a member of a conference at a time when I was putting the WAC back together, and we had new schools and new coaches, and Roy came in and talked about the SEC and, you know, and what it means. And so I was able to withstand that, and I'm, you know, sure that I hope that Pete and Jim can come back together and work for the good of the cause.
Carl Benson, I appreciate you. Thank you for joining us, former commissioner of the WAC and the MAC, Mid-American Conference, and the Sun Belt. Good perspective on the Group of Five. It is a special day today, and tomorrow especially. Tomorrow is really special because the Bald-Faced Truth Foundation, which helps kids in art, music, education, and athletics, has kind of our day and a half long celebration of kids in our community. I'm going to talk about that coming up. Plus, we'll give you the latest on Sharon Moore as Michigan pivots. Is it going to be Jed Fish? Steven, are they going after Jed? Does Washington fan need to be nervous right now?
Nervous or happy, depending on how you feel about Jed Fish. Right? Like, I mean, I honestly kind of think that, but I mean, Fish, he hasn't signed an extension with Washington. So yeah, no. I mean, I think if you are a Washington fan, you're a Jed Fish fan, you may need to watch out for Jed Fish to Michigan.
And the only part of that should bother you if you're a Washington fan is the timing of it. And I keep coming back to that, like, it's really hard for Washington State, because Washington State right now is trying to drill down on who to hire as their next football coach. And I did talk a little bit with Rick Neuheisel in the last 2 days. And, you know, he's having a conversation today with Washington State's president, Elizabeth Cantwell. And he's spoken to the athletic director at Washington State. I don't know how serious a candidate he is, but he's a candidate. And I think Washington State's trying to figure out, all right, life after Jimmy Rogers, what do we do here? How do we do this? And, you know, January 2nd is looming. That's when the portal opens. But you want to have your coach in place before January 2nd. You want to give your coach a chance to maybe have a few days of fundraising before January 2nd and get an idea of, like, hey, let me recruit my own roster and then go after what I need. So there is a time element here for Washington State that is imperative. Now comes, like, because Washington State couldn't have seen Penn State was going to take so long. They get Matt Campbell. Iowa State turns and grabs Jimmy Rogers. The food chain is, this is how it works. It's just down the food chain. Now comes Washington State. Now Washington State poaches Montana State's coach. Then Montana State's got to go look for a new coach. It's just a, there's a food chain thing working on down the line here. Washington's not a food chain thing. Washington is, can you believe what Sharon Moore did? Like, you can't make it up. Again, I'm going to give him 48 hours before I render my full judgment here. I want a little bit more, a little bit more, but I'm not hearing great things, not reading great things. And my friends who cover Michigan are saying, yeah, everyone kind of knew that some of this stuff was going on behind the scenes. And I'm like, well, why wasn't it reported? You know, but still, this was not a food chain thing at Washington. It was a food chain thing when Kalen DeBoer got poached, because Alabama's at the top of the food chain. And they turned around and they went, we want that guy. And they took him. So now Michigan, top of the food chain. But here's the problem. This wasn't like a normal, hey, we're going to move on from our coach. Sharon Moore went 9-3. He lost to Ohio State. Somebody in the athletic department apparently tipped off administrators at Michigan, said, hey, there's an improper relationship going on. And oh, man, was there more to it. And then Michigan goes, well, we can't have that, especially if it's going to get out. We need to look like we're serious about this stuff. And so Michigan fires him. And now this is not ideal for Washington. So if you're going to lose Jed Fish, you prefer that Jed goes, you know, a couple weeks ago, right after the Oregon game. And Jed goes, hey, I'm out. I'm leaving. I'm going to Florida, right? Because that leaves you more options. If you're Washington, now what do you do if Jed goes? I guess Jonathan Smith's out there, and that's a guy they would have hired in the last cycle, but has the shine come off Jonathan Smith? There's some other people out there, too. But it's less than ideal, or do you just go, hey, we need an interim coach, and we buy ourselves a year, and we regroup? I had a Washington fan come up to me today at this event I was speaking at, and they said, you know, if Jed gets poached, what do you do if you're Washington? And oh, by the way, is this just going to be how it is? Every 2-3 years, we're going to lose our coach. And I said, it'll be that way until Washington develops a homegrown coach that's got ties to Washington or Seattle that make this person a forever hire. That's kind of what Oregon has done with Dan Lanning. They hired a guy whose alma mater is William Jewell College. It's not like he's going to leave Oregon to go coach William Jewell. So, you know, he's untethered in that way. But Washington's got to find one like that or develop a coach and stick a coach on the, you know, in the offensive coordinator position who's a former Husky who you can grow into the next guy. Otherwise, you are playing this game at Washington. And Washington fans don't want to be viewed as a stepping stone. But the reality is, you're not an upper-tier Big Ten team, so you're going to lose to the Michigans. You're going to lose to the Alabamas of the world if you have success. And that is your reality. Stick around. We got so much more to talk about. Big day, special day, and special couple days. Go to bftauction.com. You want to see some of those great auction items. There's going to be more auction items added. Tomorrow on the show, we will pump it up even more. The auction lots will close tomorrow at 6 o'clock, so it's a great time to get a looky-loo right now and share it with friends and family. BFTauction.com. Stick around. You got the bald-faced truth statewide.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
One of the cool things about this radio show is that, you know, it reaches out and impacts people in ways I never imagined possible. And I think it is lost on some people who just listen to, you know, other sports radio shows. And you got people that are tap dancing, trying to entertain you, whatnot. And certainly we do some tap dancing here. Steven, you're quite a tap dancer. But one of the coolest things about the show is that I think it's impacted a lot of people, a lot of kids over the years. We've done some powerful things on this show, and none of them more powerful than the kids of the Bald-Faced Truth Foundation. The BFT Foundation was founded in 2009. It helps kids in art, music, education, and athletics. You hear me drone on and on about Camp Exceptional, the summer camp for special needs and typical kids that the camp that the nonprofit puts on. It's the highlight of my summer every year. Got a bunch of kids that get to participate in things that they wouldn't otherwise get to participate in. And I'm really proud of that, and could not do it without our sponsors. Could not do it without people like Mark and Wilsonville Carpet and Tile. Fist bump to them. Couldn't do it without people like Steve at Jamba. Steve and the team at Jamba. Could not do it without Bess and the team at Gresham Ford. Could not do it without the Hubber family, the Shoe Mill Shoe Stores, or Birch's Shoes and Birch's Shoe Outlet in Eugene. Shout out to all those entities. Couldn't do it without Rick and his sons and the team at The Wall. We could not do it without Milwaukee Lumber. Steve and his family at Milwaukee Lumber. Love those guys. We've got big hearts. Not just running a lumber yard. We couldn't do this without, the Hogue family. And we couldn't do this without the Candlish family. And we couldn't do this without Harvey Platt. And we couldn't do this without a bunch of people that this time of year come together and say, hey, how do we make your radiothon or how do we make your fundraiser at the end of the year a better thing? And Hillsborough Hops step up and they offer a first pitch VIP adventure. You ever thrown out a first pitch at a professional baseball game? Talk about a Christmas gift that you could give to somebody who you think has everything. How about this? You're going to a professional baseball game, the new stadium in Hillsborough, and you're going to throw out the first pitch at the game. Merry Christmas. That auction lot is available at BFT Auction right now. If you go to bftauction.com, you can see that auction lot. There's a guided fishing trip on the Willamette and the Columbia River. There are Trailblazers courtside seat tickets. There are Blazers Lakers center court tickets. There Oregon Ducks, Kelly Graves and the women's basketball program at Oregon have donated a VIP behind the scenes tour where you get to sit courtside. You even get to go in for the chalk talk and hear the team before the game, get to rub shoulders with the players that'll be passing through off to the WNBA. There's a Pacific City Beach vacation home auction lot that is out there. Really cool. It is three nights on the Oregon coast at the Pelican Villa. So really cool. Thank you for the Sanderson family for donating that. That has been a big hit year after year, if you want to check that out. So quite a few auction lots and items and something really for everyone. But the one that I want to talk about just for a second is one that was donated. By the way, there's a bottle of whiskey on there too. Collector's edition, Westward Whiskey, edition number one. First edition is on there as well. If you are a whiskey collector or you have a whiskey collector in your family, you might want to check that out. But here's one that jumped out at me and I want to talk about just for a second here, since we've been on the subject a little bit on today's show about basketball. Marshall Cho, you've heard his name because Marshall Cho was one of the best basketball coaches in the region. He was the head coach and has been the head coach for a couple of years now of the World Select team at the Nike Hoop Summit. He's coached Team USA in the past, junior team. He was the former coach at Lake Oswego High School, 8 seasons there. And he was, coach of the year 3 times, won the Three Rivers League 3 times, former director of basketball operations at the University of Portland. Dematha Catholic High School in Maryland. You may have heard of it. Jeremy Grant, Quinn Cook, Jerry and Grant, Victor Oladipo. Like, there have been some really good players that went through there that he coached. Basically, he knows what he's doing, okay? He knows he's not Jimmy jacking around out there on the court. And I would have no problem sending young players to Marshall Cho and saying, hey, this guy's going to make your player better. Well, he has stepped up. And he has offered an auction lot for a group or a team. It is a coaching session led by Marshall Cho. You can have him attend your team's practice. You can have him run the practice. You can assemble a small group of players and he will instruct and guide the group. If you've got a group of players that you that you're interested in having coached by Marshall Cho, this could be for an existing team. This could be for, hey, your kid and some of their friends. This could be any age group. He's willing to do that. There's an auction lot there that the winning bidder gets one group or team coaching session led by Marshall Cho. This is gold. The approximate value of this, I would put at around $1,500. The starting bid is $250 on that. So if you were a parent, and you were like, it would be really cool. have Marshall Cho, who's got all this coaching experience, come out and work with a youth basketball team. Have him come out and coach a group of, you know, your kid and their friends, whatever it may be. I want to thank Marshall for donating that. And I think it's a really interesting and unusual auction item that is at bftauction.com. You can also go to baldfacetruth.org if you want to check that out. Here's another one. You know Softy from KJR in Seattle. He comes on this show about once a year. He's outrageous. He is the largest, biggest husky honk in the land. And, you know, no, an unapologetic homer. Softy has agreed to create a video message for a winning bidder at bftauction.com. There's an auction lot right now. Is it a prank gift for a Duck fan? Is it a real gift for a Husky fan? I don't know. But Softy will create a personalized video message for a person of your choice. You want to wish a Duck fan a happy birthday from Softy? Well, he'll do it. Do you want to surprise a Husky fan with a pregame video pep talk? Do you want to wish a couple a happy anniversary or another occasion? It is a very unique personalized video message from Softy that you can give to a Duck fan. I think it would be a tremendous prank gift. It would also be a real gift if there's a Husky fan out there who just loves Softy. You can do that as well. But I want to thank Softy for doing that. You can see all the auction items at bftauction.com or go to baldfacetruth.org. And you can just click through. And if you'd like to just make a donation and support the BFT Foundation, you want to send a kid to camp, you want to send somebody to drama camp, you want to fund a library, you can do all of that by going to baldfacetruth.org. You can make a tax-deductible donation, charitable donation towards the end of the year here. Some people are often looking for those kinds of donations. It would be a really cool thing for you to get involved. But it's near and dear to me. It's something that I obviously value this relationship, because I said this at the beginning, like, you know, I'm talking on radio, I'm here, I'm engaging with listeners. It's cool. It's great. There's so much value in what we're doing here, but there's part of me doing this radio show that it's not tangible. And I was talking about this with a couple of guys who work at The Wall, one of the great sponsors of the show, buythewall.com. And I was putting in a pathway in the front of a rental house that we own. And I was putting this pathway in, and these, I wasn't doing it. They were doing it. And I was talking to the guys as they were kind of sitting there getting ready to pour the concrete. And I was like, I really envy that the jobs that people have that are listeners of the show, where you have something tangible to show for your workday at the end of the day. I envy people who build fences and houses and pour concrete. And I envy teachers who work with students and can look back at the end of the year and see the progress of a student. You know, look at their test scores. They've just progressed rapidly. I envy coaches who can work with a team and go, look at how much better the team is at the end of the year versus the beginning of the year. I envy people who can see progress and have tangible benefit to show for their work, because I don't have that on this show. I don't. The show ends, and yeah, there's a podcast that's left in the wake of it, but I don't know if I leave the world a better place at the end of a radio show. I don't know if I have actually, you know, I haven't changed anything tangibly. You know, we've talked in concepts and talked in ideas, and we have, exchanged, made people think or laugh or created a diversion for people. And so I, over the years, what I've leaned on is the idea that, like, if nothing else, at the end of this radio show each day, I hope that we have an impact on you, but I also hope that, like, collectively, we can look over at kids in our community who are maybe not having opportunities in art, music, education, and athletics, and we can say to them, hey, there's a nonprofit here that can provide opportunities for kids who might not otherwise have them. And that's what the BFT Foundation does. Since 2009, more than 15,000 kids have been able to go and participate in a summer camp or play a sport or, rent a musical instrument or whatever that need may be. Teachers have leaned on the nonprofit over the years. Schools have leaned on it. A lot of times teachers are paying for that stuff out of their own pocket. But I feel like at the end of the day, it's not like building a fence. It's not like pouring concrete, but you know, maybe we've had an impact on some of these kids that may get to do something they wouldn't otherwise get to do. And I think that's the coolest thing ever. All right, we have so much more radio ahead. We got a great show, but I encourage you to go to bftauction.com if you want to check out those auction lots. And we will keep it rolling here on this great Thursday. We're going to lead you right into Thursday night football coming up. You got the bald-faced truth statewide on the BFT Radio Network.
It's that.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
A little bit of disco. That what we got here, Steven? A little disco?
This is actually Kid Rock.
Okay, but it sounds a little disco-y. It sounds a little 70-ish.
It does. It has a little 70s on.
A little 70s. Portland State Football Hiring Committee, Athletic Director Matt Billings, the university, they have offered the job to Central Washington coach Chris Fisk. And Chris Fisk has accepted the job. He will be the next football coach at Portland State. He is coming to Portland State from the Division II Central Washington. He's 48 years old. He grew up in Idaho, played for Dirk Cutter's dad, Jim, while he was in high school. He was 47-21 in 7 seasons at Central Washington. I can tell you this. It appeared to me, and I'm knee-deep in this Portland search, whether they want me in this thing or not, Portland State. I'm knee-deep in this search. But it appeared to me that Portland State was zeroing in on Division II coaches who had successful runs. They interviewed 3 D2 coaches, Fisk from Central Washington, Jay Long from Chadron State, and Jas Baines from Western Colorado. I reported this 2 days ago that I thought Fisk, Long, and Baines, that one of those three would get the job. And Fisk is 48, grew up in Idaho, as I mentioned. I think he gets the job here because Central Washington has some budget challenges as well. He has overcome those things. He's a winner. He's 47-21. And so Fisk, to me, ends up getting this job because he's done it before with less. He's made more with less at Central Washington. But I think the reason that they zeroed in on D2 coaches was that the salary pool for the staff of assistants at Portland State last season was a mere $600,000. Salary pool of $600,000. The D2 coaches, I think, are less likely to be horrified by that. Program builders, but less likely to be turned off by the fact that there's only a $600,000 budget for all of your staff of assistants. Your assistant coaching pool is an important pool of money. And, for people at Oregon State, for example, Trent Bray's staff had about $5 million. Okay. Portland State has $600,000. Oregon's staff is approaching $10 million. So there's the investment level that you have if you are these specific schools. That's the relative investment level that you're getting, when it comes to that. So I think if you are a Portland State fan, you look at it and you go, hey, they got a D2 guy. Steven, how does it strike you? You got a D2 guy, maybe he's a program builder, but I think the bigger questions are for Matt Billings, the athletic director, and for Ann Cudd, the president at Portland State. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately for Portland State, like if you're going to hire a new coach, it's probably going to be from the D2 level that's had success. And Chris Fisk has had success. He's been in the playoffs, Division II playoffs 4 out of the last 5 years. And so, you know what? You go out and you get a guy that is familiar with Northwest, familiar with building up a program and maintaining a level at a program that he's had at Central Washington. I mean, they got to the quarterfinal 1 year. So, I mean, it's a wait to see how it performs higher. But if you're thinking you can go out and get some guy from the D1 level, like a position coach, it's going to be different when you get to Portland State because you're right. It's about the money. And I think that a guy like Chris Fisk, who, hasn't had a lot of money working with Central Washington, like he'll understand how to build this type of thing, maybe bring some players over with him. I think it's kind of – if you're a smaller school, I think nowadays, John, you go and you hire someone that's had a lot of success on the level below you, because he's going to bring a lot of his players with you. We've seen it in basketball. We've seen it in football too, you know, especially James Madison, Indiana, Cignetti, all those guys. I think if you're Portland State, same type of thing. You go get one of these kind of schools and you have him bring some players over, and it may work out quickly. I mean, think about like when Shante Leggins went to Portland, University of Portland, he brought a lot of his Eastern Washington guys with him. Like, this is just kind of what the world is. And so Central Washington, good team on the D2 level, bring some players over, and you got some, got a little building block there.
I also, though, you know, I fear for what is going to happen with that Portland State program, and Fisk is the next guy in. And look, it's a thankless job at Portland State. I think the first thing is he's got to get the team playing downtown again. The fact that they aren't playing downtown is just such an obstacle. You can't have your games be out in Hillsborough. You've got to get downtown. I think it's going to take everything and everyone that he's got. I think, but the key is get the team downtown and get the team back. And I feel like it's a huge challenge. I feel like he's got a lot of things stacked against him. I feel like we're watching Squid Game a little bit. Like, you know, Bruce Barnum was playing Squid Game and Nigel Burton was playing Squid Game. And, you know, the contestants are lasting longer and longer. But nonetheless, you know, I won't be surprised if this doesn't work, because there's so much stacked against the guy. And I hate to start his tenure saying that, because normally when a coach comes in, you start talking about hope. You start talking about belief. You start talking about all the excitement. You start talking about all the things that are going possibly lined up in their direction to be successful. And with a guy like Chris Fisk, it's like, hey, good luck.
It's the theme of the week, John. Actions are louder than words. Like, we've seen the actions of Portland State the last, 25 years?
Kidding.
Like, we know it's an uphill battle. So it's hard. Yes, like, you want to be excited, but it's also hard to say, I expect these things out of Chris Fisk to turn around Portland State, because that doesn't really happen there. It's an uphill battle, but you know what? You get a guy that hopefully can build it up and turn it into a little something.
And I like, though, I mean, in his favor, I like that, you know, Central Washington, he's had success someplace where he hasn't, you know, had all the funding in the world at the Division II level. But I will be really curious to see if he can elevate this. And, you know, I broke the news on social media about 4 or 5 minutes ago. And Fisk is supposed to inform his team either late tonight or tomorrow morning, I am told. And then we will effort to get him on the show as soon as possible.
Get him on the show.
Maybe Monday's show, Monday or so, Chris Fisk, who knows? Maybe we'll get the AD on. Maybe the AD will come out of hiding and come on this radio show. Who knows? All right, the 5 at 5 is coming up, top of the hour. Steven's got the 5 biggest stories. Stick around.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
We will get Chris Fisk on the show. A lot of people in the state of Washington saying nice things about him. Division II coach there at Central Washington. He'll be the next guy in at Portland State. We will we'll get Fisk on the program. We might even get the athletic director at Portland State on the show. Settle our differences. Time for a sit-down, maybe. We'll see what happens there. Steven's got the 5 biggest stories in sports. We're going to lead you right into Thursday night football right here on 750 The Game and across the BFT radio network. Appreciate everybody who makes this show part of your day. On tomorrow's show, we're going to go heavy. Heavy with sports, college football, the NFL, coaching carousel. We'll have the latest on what's going on with Michigan. But Steven, before we get to that, the 5 biggest stories in sports. Let's do it.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, the Sharon Moore story continues to grow and get a little more clearer. As Sharon Moore, of course, fired yesterday by the University of Michigan, the football coach. Now, the story today is he remains in custody as a suspect in an alleged assault and is expected to appear in court for arraignment tomorrow on Friday, but authorities still have not released details about Moore's arrest other than to say that he remains under investigation. There are a lot of rumors about what's going on, but none of it has been factually correct or anything like that. Nobody knows anything. But Moore was incarcerated at the Washtenaw County Jail.
I had trouble with that one too.
I read Washington, you know.
Yep.
But he was there hours after he was fired by Michigan for the inappropriate relationship with a staff member. So we should find out tomorrow exactly what Sharone Moore is being charged with.
Well, I think the 48-hour rule needs to apply here. And some of this for Sharone Moore, I mean, you can look at it and you can go, this is a mess. What was this guy thinking? Well, you know, I throw this in the category, too, of like, my sense is we're going to end up in the same place we ended up with Chauncey Billups, and we're going to go, why? What? Why? Like, you know, Mel Tucker? Why? I think we're going to end up in that same area, but let's give this 48 hours. And let's also find out what Michigan knew and when they knew it. Because the report is that, you know, Michigan got tipped off weeks ago. And I just can't help but wonder if Michigan sat around and waited for the Ohio State game just to see how that one was going to go before they decided what to do with Sharone Moore. I can't help it. Maybe I'm jaded by what I have seen across college athletics.
Number two.
Well, some tentacles off of the Sharone Moore firing is quarterback Bryce Underwood. He was the true freshman starting quarterback for Michigan last season. Reportedly, he got about $10 to $12 million over 4 years to flip his commitment from LSU to Michigan going into last season. But according to Pete Nakos of On3 Sports, Underwood's contract, John, does not include a buyout from the University of Michigan. So Underwood's camp is paying very close attention to who the next hire will be. Ooh. He is not officially entered the transfer portal or anything like that, but it is known that his contract does not include a buyout, so he could up and leave after he got that $10 to $12 million deal over 4 years from Michigan and be maybe the hottest quarterback on the transfer portal market. I think if, you know, they go out and they get maybe a head coach like a Jed Fish, Kalen DeBoer, maybe he goes back to Michigan because they're good offensive coaches. So it'll be interesting to see who Michigan ends up hiring as a head coach and how much of an effect or how much influence a guy like Bryce Underwood may have on that hire.
Here's the other thing. If Fish gets the job, does Damon Williams Jr. go with him?
And then Underwood, they do a little trade. Underwood gets traded to Washington.
Underwood gets underhanded.
At what point how far are we away from trades in college football?
It's coming. I mean,
because we kind of had one with Nico Iamaleava and Joey Aguilar last season.
Yeah, I think if you are a fan of salary caps, if you are a fan of like level the playing field, the portal's crazy. You're waiting for players to collectively bargain and become employees, and then you're going, okay, then you're under contract. But I don't know. Can you trade a college kid? Can you say, hey, you can no longer go to school at North Carolina? You got to go to Boise State now. I don't think you can. I think that it might be a little different.
Number three.
And we got maybe a little preview of what might happen for the Heisman Trophy, as today Indiana quarterback Fernando Mendoza was named AP College Football Player of the Year. Mendoza, of course, helped lead Indiana to the one seed in the college football playoff. He received 32 of the 51 first place votes. Second in the voting was Diego Pavia, the quarterback from Vanderbilt. He got 9 first place votes. Ohio State quarterback Julian Sand, he got 5 first-place votes, and Notre Dame running back Jeremiah Love got 3 first-place votes, and of course, those are the 4 who are heading to New York. After that, Texas Tech linebacker Jacob Rodriguez got 2 first-place votes as well, and he will not be going to New York. But Fernando Mendoza, AP College Football Player of the Year, the big-time favorite in the betting markets to win the Heisman Trophy as well.
Yeah, I think he'll win the Heisman. Interestingly, I only had 2 of the finalists on my ballot. I pretty much... I'm not supposed to say what my ballot is.
For what it's worth, the Heisman Trophy put out their top 10 of votes. Dante Moore not included in the top 10.
Yeah, my third place person did not make the top 10. So that's how bad I look. Yeah, the LSU fans are going to be really mad at me. You're mad at me that I didn't vote Jaden.
Dude, watch, bro.
They're so mad at me. I didn't vote Jaden Daniels first. I put him second on my ballot, and they freaked out because I said he would hold a clipboard for Michael Penix. They freaked out.
Ohio State has 3 of the top 10 in the top 10 Heisman Trophy right now.
This is just so bad. So bad. This is supposed to be the award for the best college football player in America. Come on.
Number 4.
Best player in America. The NFL is going to tell us who the best player in America is.
Some big-time news here for the San Antonio Spurs, as last night they beat the Lakers 132-119 in the NBA Cup quarterfinals. They're now heading to the semifinals where they'll take on the Thunder, but the news is much better as they may have Victor Wembanyama back in the lineup for that game. Head coach Vince Johnson said he had a really good day, had very intense training in the morning, and then they have to see how he responds. But Wembanyama went through an intense workout and then worked out again during pregame warmups and got through all of it without any extra protection on his strained calf. Wembanyama's been sidelined with that calf strain and hasn't played for almost a month. November 16th was the last time he played. He's been awesome when he played, 26 points, 13 rebounds, 3.5 blocks a game. The Spurs are actually really good, even without him, 17-7 overall, fifth in the Western Conference. But they'll take on the Thunder on Saturday in Las Vegas for that NBA Cup. I don't care about the NBA Cup, but what I do care about is Victor Wembanyama coming back. And if the NBA wants to build this NBA Cup, they want Wembanyama playing in that game to try to like boost it up a little bit. I'm excited, man. Wembanyama, he's out there, John. He is such a difference maker. He is a legitimate Hall of Fame talent, like, you know, GOAT status type of player. Like, that's how good he is. He's just been so hurt so far in his career, man. I just wanted to be healthy. Would love to see the Spurs go up against the Thunder in that game, because the Thunder are head and shoulders above everybody in the league.
Yeah.
But when you got Wembanyama, he's the best player on the court. So how can that deal with it? I hope he's back for Saturday.
Yeah, look, I hope he gets back as well, but, you know, big part of this is, you know, you're an NBA fan, you want these little mini tournaments and these events that they put on throughout the season to be successful. Adam Silver's hoping they get ratings and interest in these things, and you're right, players move the needle, not the logo or the name of the event, it's players, and you need Wemby healthy and on the court.
Number five.
The NFC South battle on Thursday Night Football. Falcons traveling to the Bucks. Falcons are out of the playoff race, but the Bucks, they are 7-6, but are tied with the upstart Carolina Panthers for the first place in that NFC South. So big one tonight in Tampa. Tampa Bay currently 6-point favorites at home over the Falcons. Mike Evans is back in playing after his injury, and Jalen McMillan making his debut as well.
Hey, look, you always go with the NFL on the Thursday night with your fifth pick.
I love it.
And I like that.
That's what we're leading up to, man.
I like that you lead right into it.
Well, they're boosting us off the air for the game.
Yeah, you're a momentum guy.
If you're gonna kick us off the air, at least listen to what they're boosting us off for.
Yep. So there's that as well. All right. So coming up, we have Thursday Night Football. Tomorrow on the show, we have the BFT jury. Of course, that's always great. We have the BFT jury on Fridays, always. We'll also be pushing hard with the BFT auction, bftauction.com, to help the kids of the Bald-Faced Truth Foundation. There's a whole bunch of sports memorabilia items that are going to be listed hourly overnight and into tomorrow. So if you check out bftauction.com, you want to go back, check often, see how it goes. It should be a lot of fun on tomorrow's show. We're going to raise some money for kids, and certainly, if you're a Blazer fan, there's some Blazers courtside tickets there, Blazers Lakers tickets there, and some really special and unique auction items, including Coach Marshall Cho doing a private coaching lesson for your kid's team. Cho, obviously, part of that Nike Hoop Summit, coaches one of the teams in that. You're getting high-level coaching there. A lot of fun little auction items, and, of course, it'll be beefed up overnight and into tomorrow, and we'll talk about it on tomorrow's show. I appreciate everybody who makes this radio program part of their day. We broke a little news on the show today. Central Washington coach Chris Fisk is the next football coach at Portland State. He has been hired. The Bald-Faced Truth not here for a long time. Just a good time. Have a great night, everybody.